Hello there, friends. Welcome to Exolore, the show that helps you imagine other worlds with facts and science. I am your host, Dr. Moya McTeer. I'm an astrophysicist who studied pretty much everything in space, from planetary orbits to the radiation left over from the Big Bang to star formation and black holes and galaxy evolution. But I am especially interested in the motion of stars and how that affects the habitability of exoplanets, which are planets outside of our solar system. I am also a folklorist who specializes in building and analyzing fictional worlds, and this podcast is my way of sharing those worlds and that knowledge with you. So let's get started. Hello and welcome back, Exolorists. It is another episode of Exolore, this one diving deep into the world of paleo art, which is a world that I have been interested in. And I think that especially now with all of the Jurassic Park movies and the BBC Prehistoric Planet things coming out, it's a good time to hear about paleo art. So I have a great guest for you, for me. I'm really excited to learn a lot. I am joined by Beth Zakin, who's a paleo artist, an illustrator, and the lead muralist at Blue Rhino Studio. Beth, thank you so much for being with me today.
Hey, Moya. Thanks for having me.
Ooh, I'm so excited that you're here. Would you like to say more about who you are and what you do in your own words?
I mean, I think you kind of covered most of what I usually say. I'm a professional illustrator. I'm an artist. I specialize in paleo art, science communication, and like general narrative interpretation with an educational bent. I'm probably best known for my large-scale natural history murals and my, you know, production work for museums around the world as part of my full-time work as a principal artist at Blue Rhino Studio. Blue Rhino is, you know, a well-known museum fabrication company based in Minneapolis, Minnesota.
Okay. What types of things does Blue Rhino Studios illustrate? What types of things do you illustrate? Is it all dinosaurs?
It's not all dinosaurs. We actually, we're more of a general purpose museum exhibit fabricator, but we do work for visitor centers, zoos, aquariums, cultural institutions all over the world. These days, like the majority of our work is based in paleo art. We do a lot of dinosaurs. We've done things for nature centers. We've done things for, you know, aquariums and history exhibits and like roadside kind of stuff. We started out in the 90s as a general like retail fabricator, became more and more specialized over time. So these days we are well known as like a high-end natural history exhibit producer.
That's awesome. When you say fabricator, like I've heard of fabricators in the film industry, right? Like making all of those really cool props. Is that similar to what you do?
You can think of us as like a all-purpose furniture. Like if you go into a museum and you look around you and there are beautifully built like furniture pieces and reading rails and constructed platforms and graphics and sculptures and illustrations and murals and art and fabricated ground forms or immersive exhibits, fake plants, fake trees, rocks, all of that stuff is stuff you can get from us.
That's so cool. Yes, I want to learn so much more about that and these worlds that you get to create through your art. But first, I want to know what fictional worlds not of your own making that you've been inhabiting lately. Have you been reading, watching, or playing anything cool?
I have the privilege of like living in prehistoric worlds on like a daily basis. I would be sick of the dinosaurs, but I did just get out to see the new Jurassic Park movie. And that was a huge blast, like coming on the heels of the Prehistoric Planet release. So, you know, welcome to Hot Dinosaur Summer.
Woo-hoo! Hot Dino Summer. Love it. I haven't seen the new Jurassic Park movie yet. How did you feel it compared to the previous ones?
You know, it's real heavy on the nostalgia. They're just playing all the classics in that movie, playing them over again. It was a good, like, sort of closure of the series, I think. But, very much like a Hollywood monster movie. It's all the greatest hits.
Good. Okay, now let's get into paleo art. First, what is it? and what does it specifically mean to you? Because I feel like this might be something where everyone kind of has their own idea of what it is and what's included.
That's a good question. Paleo art is like any art in any media that endeavors to bring something extinct back to life truthfully. It kind of exists in this liminal space between art and science And it can be anything on a spectrum from like really artistic, imaginative, you know, wildly creative images to like a disciplined, scientific, like rigorous academic approach. Mm. And it follows rules from both of those worlds. I sometimes say as a discipline, it sits inside a Venn diagram of like science, art, and masochism. It's right there in the center.
Where's the masochism coming from? Is it just really hard to commit to depictions of these creatures?
It's just more trouble, you know? Like you could be just a paleontologist, you could be just an artist and make things a lot easier on yourself. Paleo artists like to take the hardest possible path. It's also the gateway to science. You'll hear people say that a lot. It's sort of the most impressive, like interesting, fantastical, compelling way to explain what we know about like history of the planet to the public. And in that way, like that whole story, that history of Earth, of life on Earth, is something that we all have a claim to. Like it's like a fairy tale or a legend with these like larger than life characters and like millennia long storylines, but it's like written every day by scientists. And so it's open to everyone. It belongs to everyone because it's like our shared history of life on the planet.
I love that. Because we need to know what things look like if we're really going to be able to imagine the past in any sort of realistic way.
Yeah. And it helps bring people into science. It gives them like an accessible connection, a gateway to like be more connected to science in general, which is so important now. It's like more important now than ever, because science is what gives us like an objective reality that we can all use to base collective decisions on.
Yeah, absolutely. You're preaching to the choir, but I will like shout out what you say from the pulpit. Yeah, we absolutely need better understanding of science through the ages. So I'm really glad that you're doing what you're doing.
More science for more people.
Yes, absolutely. How did you get into this field? Did you come more from the paleontology side or the art side?
I definitely came from the art side. I did art in a very serious way from a very young age, and I came up through the Rhode Island School of Design. I graduated with a bachelor's in illustration, but I had a hard time deciding between art and science as like a direction for my life. I ended up going with art because it's more of like a personal challenge. So I felt like I could have like really challenged myself to grow and see like tangible results, I guess.
Mm-hmm. That's nice.
But I was always really connected with science and particularly biology. So it was always like there in my background, something I like understood and loved and really valued, because I was always really interested in animals and the natural world and nature and being outside. When I was a kid, I would just like catch any creature I possibly could and, you know, trap bugs and do all these little like drawings of animals. I thought I was going to be like a wildlife painter. I loved wildlife painting growing up. So I did that from a really early age. And that kind of turned into a focus on science and natural history, communication, biology. And then also had this like huge secondary interest in like fantasy worlds and fantasy painting, you know, science fiction, that kind of illustration, like imaginative realism. So those two things combined. And what came out of it is a kind of a purpose in life to like pursue educational or like informative, traditionally grounded art in my life. So I kind of bounced around after college. I worked on an archaeological dig and I ended up joining the Blue Rhino crew to do like museum art fabrication, you know, exhibits and explain science and things to the world. And Blue Rhino just became more and more specialized over time because everyone there became like, you know, what's the best thing that we do that's like the most fun? Dinosaurs. We just kind of like pursued more and more of those projects and became really good at them. And that's kind of where we are today. We have a majority of our work is based in natural history museums and like large scale paleo art kind of features.
So cool. What was your first project, your first paleo art project?
Well, I did do some paleo art in college as like part of my senior thesis equivalent at RISD was actually based on like Ice Age world environmental illustrations, big landscapes with mammoths and glaciers and things. But like the first official, like big professional paleo art thing that I kind of remember is we got to do the Mammoths and Mastodons traveling exhibit for the Field Museum in 2010. We landed that at Blue Rhino and I was so excited. Like I was dancing around like, yes, let me know. And we got to work with like Dan Fisher and some of those people that are working on like the cutting edge, like mammoth research and tusk cross sections. And we did all these huge reconstructions. There's a Colombian mammoth and a dwarf mammoth and this like standing bear. It's like 13 feet tall, an Arctotis short-faced bear, a Homotherium, which is this crazy like cat that's sort of built like a hyena with these tall shoulders. Just really fun, like the most fun creatures. Because up until that point, we had done mostly like modern natural history stuff, which I also love. But oh man, that mammoth.
And these are like the almost like taxidermied, like the big 3D structures, not the paintings, right?
Yes, like full life reconstructions. We did like, you know, skin pad textures and plugged little hairs in. They have eyelashes. They were beautiful. They're still beautiful. They're still touring. I think they're at the La Brea Tar Pits right now, actually.
Oh, okay. So anyone in LA, go out and see those mammoths.
It's a traveling exhibit. So it has been all over for 10 years. And I think that's where they are planning on staying.
That's awesome. I feel like if I had a traveling exhibit, I would be so tempted to follow it around. How many times did you see it after it was out of your control?
I saw it only one time after it left our shop. I saw it at the Natural History Museum in San Diego. It was really nice. They're starting to look a little beat up, but still really good.
Wow, that's a testament to your craftsmanship, really, that it still looks these good. Because I know that when things move around, like they get destroyed. So if they still look that awesome, then...
I was a little concerned, but yeah, it looks great. Still looks great.
Good, good. So I do want to talk a bit about the murals that you make, because it seems like that's a big part of your work. And they are gorgeous. They do such a great job of like transporting me to one of those ancient worlds. So I would love to know what your process is from start to finish. How do you create one of those murals? What's the first step?
I'm creating a world, right, with the murals. Mm-hmm. When I start, it's a world that isn't just pulled out of nowhere. It's a thing that we know existed, right? So that means that there's information out there to be found about what I'm trying to do. So to begin with, you kind of have to approach it like a journalist. I have to go in and find as much information as I can. Like, so figure out like, what's the time period, the location, the where, the when, like, what is the climate like? What are the plant species found there? Why are they there? What are the conditions that allow them to grow there? And then like, how does the animal or animals fit into this ecosystem? So I'll look at like current research, or sometimes there's skeletal reconstructions done by other very talented artists. Those kind of things help me like build a more complete picture of the ecosystem I'm trying to build. And that's where you have to start. And from there, I can sort of bring it into an art world, but the science comes first.
Can we start even earlier? Like, where does the concept come from? Does a museum or someone reach out to you saying, hey, we want a piece for this exhibit? Or do you come up with ideas and propose them to museums and zoos?
That would be awesome. Sign me up for that.
Okay, so what actually happens?
Yeah, usually these are assignments, and they come from a lot of different places. Sometimes I will have specific murals that they only need a piece of this, like for their museum, like they just need the mural. Sometimes it's a mural that's part of a larger exhibit or part of an immersive environment. So it's something that has to coordinate and work with other pieces that are already being built or have been built. But usually it's the client comes to us with various levels of development of this project. Like they'll have an idea at least of like what they want to see, or some of what they want to see, all the way to like they know exactly how many species they want in this piece, and they know exactly where they need to line up. I've done one where I had to do like 32 specific spot creature illustrations in like a 26 foot space, and they had to line up with like a fossil case that was immediately below that. So everyone was like in order with this case that was already built.
Wow. Do you paint them in the museum, or are they separate pieces that you ship to the museums?
I used to do traditional, like hand-painted on canvas kind of murals. That's what I started out doing when I was like 16.
Wow.
In like the local school districts. Like, that's what I did. It's like my summer job. And so that's what I started out doing. And for the first probably 10 years of my career, that's how they were still done. They were done really large canvases. And then we would, you know, roll the canvas, ship it to the location, go and do the whole installation. But these days, I've made a complete transition into digital art. That makes it a lot easier on everybody, including me. I can like, you know, make these large files on the computer, you know, do lots of check-ins. There's lots of space and time for adjustments or moving things around. And then in the end, I can send this file to a printer that's more at location, and they take care of the professional, like printing and installation of a piece.
Nice. So you don't even have to worry about like the gluing and making sure everything is lined up at the end.
Yes, it's gotten a lot easier on me.
Good. Good. You put in your dues. Now you can have other people do it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So usually museums ask you to do something, you do it digitally, but what other decisions are you making along the way usually?
Often, like, my contributions are sort of on the artistic side, because the museums, they either know what they want or they have people that know what should be there. Mm-hmm. So they will put me in contact with experts, or I will talk to paleontologists or paleobotanists, and I will get sort of the rundown or their idea of what this land or this ecosystem might have looked like, or what was there, or what we know was there. And then I will go and do my research process and think about it from the artistic side, like, what could this landscape be that makes it a unique piece of art? Like, what is the climate like? What are the lighting conditions? Like, how are the creatures arranged so that they have like a beautiful sort of visual narrative, you know, mm-hmm. in a way that leads the eye through the scene? Like, what is lit prominently? What's in shadow? You know, is it raining? Is it late in the day? Is it sunset? All of these things, like, what is the color story? You know, because each mural can have sort of its own feel, different color palettes, you know?
Okay, yeah. That's a lot that you're contributing. That's all of the, you're adding in a lot of the science, but like also you're doing all of the stuff that when I look at a piece of art, I take all of those decisions for granted. Like I know that that must be something that the artist considers, like what positions should these animals be in? And you talked about the lighting and the weather, and I'm really glad that you're making those decisions, because it works out. And at the end, when I see the finished process, I really appreciate it. I was going to ask how much you feel like you have to make up in these illustrations, because it's not like we really know everything about what it would have looked like back then.
We don't, and we probably never will. But what I can do is I can figure out, what is the plant community here that we know existed? Mm-hmm. What are they related to? Why do those plants live where they do live? And what do those analogous modern landscapes look like today? And then when I go to like actually render and finish this mural, I try to, as much as possible, have a very good reason for putting things in that I do. So anything that's like highly detailed or like, you know, specifically rendered, it's there because of a reason. I know what plant species that is, and I know why it's there, and I know what time of year it is and how it looks at that time. And I consider things like, is there a drought? Is it dry here? Is it wet here? Is it like early spring? Is it midsummer? Is it fall? Are things dying? Like, what is going on at this moment in time that I'm trying to depict? And anything that I don't have a good reason, or don't have a certain knowledge that it should be there, I just kind of do visual mumbling. I don't. Yeah, I know.
Visual mumbling?
Yeah. Like, I can, because I have a painterly approach, like, you can disguise a lot of things in like brushy textures and like ambiguous background elements. Like, there's trees in a mural that I'm sort of suggesting, but I'm not rendering specifically, because I don't know what that species would be, but I do know there would be trees, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, so cool. So like other animals, if you want to put those in the background, you could mumble them, or maybe not include them.
Or maybe they're suggestive. Maybe there's a herd of something in the background that we know was like a hadrosaur, but we don't know what species it was. And we don't really want to get into like color patterns or anything like that. They can be there in a like climatic or lighting condition that just gives them, it just suggests them as silhouettes.
Interesting. Do you learn about the psychology of like looking at a piece of art when you're in art school?
A lot of art school is teaching you how to think when you're making art.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So you have a sense from your schooling and training, but also from your experience of what people will look at and what they're willing to not need in detail?
Very much so. Okay. There's basic elements that are part of like a traditional artistic training, things like values and colors and contrast and lost edges that like help you direct a viewer through a painting. A lot of the like old masters have like mastered, obviously, this. They have things that are like high contrast, that are tight, that have hard lines. That's where your eye goes first. Everything else falls away. You know, so think of like a Caravaggio painting or something where there's like the face is so beautifully lit and it's in super high contrast against a dark background. That's it, where your eye goes. That's the leading top line of that story. That's the headline. Everything else kind of is secondary details. There's fun things to find around that, but there's usually like a main point and then everything else.
Interesting. Do you start with those main points when you're making the mural?
Usually, yeah. Yeah, usually I do kind of have an idea of like, there's a main, let's say a mammoth matriarch or like a main hadrosaur who's responding to something outside of the mural in the environment, and they are reacting in a certain way, and we want that to be the first thing people see. And then there's a lot of other things in there, a lot of detail, but that's not the first thing.
Okay. So if you started working on a mural and you were working on it for a few hours and then I stopped you and came in and looked at your screen, would there be a lot of blank spaces around those main parts that you filled in earlier? Or do you do like a base layer of everything and then add in detail after that?
I usually start in like a large grayscale study. Mm. So I'll do like value studies, and the values are the first thing that helps you like sort of guide you through a painting. So they'll be like, is the foreground brightly lit against a dark background? Is it shadowed in the foreground? And then the thing that's the most lit in the background is what your eye is drawn to. You can think of like a Douglas Henderson piece where he has all of these beautiful, like dark silhouetted foliage and things. And maybe there's little animals crawling through the foreground, but the thing you see first is that brightly lit animal behind. Mm-hmm. Those are the things that I consider first when I'm starting a piece, when I'm working through that like thumbnailing process.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. Interesting. How much science, and you said that you were interested in science growing up, especially biology, but how much science did you really need to learn to do your work?
I don't have a lot of formal training in science. I'm sort of, I'm just a big nerd at heart. I'm type A. I just love my homework. I love to learn. And I'm like a natural history documentary junkie.
Mm. Well, that's learning still. Yeah. Like, you don't have to learn in school for it to be valid.
I had a pretty solid experience in biology in school. Like, I did all the AP courses and all of that. And I was lucky enough to have like a really, well-equipped public school. It was based in Southern Minnesota and sort of a medical minded town. They were training future doctors, kids basically. So I just loved science. It was always going to be a part of my life, you know, one way or another. I'm very concerned about conservation and like the environment and, you know, wildlife rehabilitation. I'm into all of this stuff just because I love animals. That was always the bottom line for me, and it still is.
Mm, so is there a science that you have had to learn and incorporate into your work that you maybe didn't love learning about so much? Even nerds find our wall where beyond that wall, we're not super interested in what's there.
The thing that I struggle with sometimes that I have picked up quite a bit of along the way by necessity is sort of geology.
Oh, yeah. That's a big one, I bet.
But I love rocks, and I love like painting different forms of rocks. So I need to know what I'm doing and what I'm looking at. It's just some of that terminology doesn't come to me as easily as others.
Well, that's fair. So, but the concepts are still
there. Yeah, I can totally understand like where these rocks come from, how they were formed, what they look like in the environment, eroded or not, you know, what colors are veining and things happen. I think about it in a visual way, but the things you have to read in geology, like it doesn't quite like translated my brain as well as some of the biologically based some things, but I try. I'm trying.
Yeah. Oh, that's a good point about geology. I haven't read many geology texts. I have learned most of my geology from geologists just speaking at me. And I think that might be easier than trying to make my way through a geology textbook.
I'd really love to do like some, you know, like field tours with a geologist.
Ooh.
I'm such a visual learner, and it's so hard with geology because it's like, you know, planetary scale things instead of something you can illustrate or document in photos very well. You have to kind of be out in the field and be like, see this ridgeline, this is this kind of rock, and what you're standing on is different, and where they meet, it's because of yada yada, you know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Someone walk me through this, please.
I want someone to walk me through what glaciers do, because I know that glaciers can move. I know that when they move, they can have a really great impact on the land that they're moving on. But I just I know that intellectually, but I just can't picture it. So yeah, I would like to be out there with a geologist being like, look, Moya, that's the glacier. It's moving this way.
I love glaciers, actually. That's the one thing I'm like really into with geology is like, I totally get the glacial, you know, movements and the expansion and contraction. Like that glacier story, it's such a blip in like the larger geology timescale, though. Mm-hmm. It's like small enough for me to understand.
Hey, if you're caught up on ExoLore and are looking for another show to try, I would recommend Join the Party. It's another show from the Multitude Collective, and it's an actual play podcast with tangible worlds, genre-pushing storytelling, and collaborators who make each other laugh each week. DM, Eric, and emphatic players Amanda, Brandon, and Julia, who have all been on ExoLore before, want to welcome everyone to the table, from longtime TTRPG players to folks who have never touched a role-playing game before, who might not even know what TTRPG stands for. They have multiple campaigns that you can hop into. Campaign number one is a high fantasy epic. Campaign number two is a modern-day comic book superpower story. And right now, they're doing a fun Monster of the Week story set in a weird and wild summer camp called Camp Pain. They have a lot of puns. It's a good time. So what are you waiting for? Pull up a chair and join the party. Search for Join the Party in your podcast app or go to jointhepartypod.com. Hey, I wrote a book and I'm really freaking proud of it. It's called The Milky Way, an autobiography of our galaxy. Barnes & Noble put it up on their home website as a nonfiction favorite, and Publishers Weekly gave it a starred review, and they don't do that for just anyone. So I am, miraculously, not tired of talking about this book yet, so I am going to do an AMA episode of ExoLore. That means that you can ask whatever questions about the book or my process for writing it or any of the things that I put inside in my words on the pages, you can ask me your questions, and then I will probably answer them. If you haven't read the book yet, if you don't have your own copy, go out and get it. What are you waiting for? For the month of September only, it's available as a Kindle deal for just $3.99. So go get a copy of The Milky Way, an autobiography of our galaxy, and then read it, and then ask me some questions, and maybe I will answer it on a future AMA episode. Now, let's get back to this conversation about fun paleo art. Do you have a favorite period or region to depict in your art?
I will get in trouble with the dinosaur people, but I love the Pleistocene period. I love like quaternary, you know, mammals, just because it's so similar. It's so familiar, but so alien, you know, the animals are there, but they're not quite how we know them. And the landscapes are there, but they're not quite how we recognize them.
Mm. When was the Pleistocene? Was that one of the more recent ones?
It was, yeah, the last, the Ice Age.
Got it. How does the Ice Age movie franchise do in terms of paleo depictions?
Oh, man. Don't make me talk about that.
Okay, we'll skip over it.
No, you know what? They're good for kids. You know, it's really great to have these creatures like sort of exist in kids from a young age. Like it gives them an idea that they existed and they can learn more about them as they're older. They're just not, they're not meant to be educational in any way.
Yeah, absolutely. That's kind of how I feel about the movie Galaxy Quest. I'm like, no one is thinking that this is an accurate depiction of space. So it's fine. So you've been in this community, this field for a while. How do you feel paleo art has changed or grown since you've started?
You know, I would say generally the availability of information is so much better now.
And good.
It's resulted in like a real sort of democratization of the field. There are a lot more people interested in doing this work. There's a lot more people, even at an amateur level, doing really good work in this field, and they should be recognized. So it's just a lot bigger today than it used to be. Like for me personally, the biggest change has been the switch from traditional media to digital media.
Mm, I bet that's helped a lot, made everything more efficient and easier to collaborate.
It's a blessing and a curse because it opens the door for like a lot more uncertainty and a lot more like changing and waffling and moving of things. Whereas if you're doing a large painting, you have to kind of like make decisions and finish things. So
yeah,
I spend more time probably on my digital work than I used to on the traditional pieces.
that's not too bad. Do you time box it? Like, how do you know when you're done?
Oh, I mean, you're never really done. you just run out of time.
Okay, so you are done when the museum is like, I need my mural. Where is it, Beth?
You're done when it's due. That's right. You put as much as you can into it, and eventually you have to let it go. They're like kids, you know?
Yeah. You got to know when to throw in the towel. Well, what about big understanding shifts in the field? Like when I grew up, I had this very firm image in my head of dinosaurs as these scaly creatures. And it feels now, I'm mostly talking about the interactions that I've had with Dustin Growick, who has convinced me that everything is now feathers. So are there other similar shifts in not just how the field is done, but like what you depict in your work?
Oh, you know, it's really interesting. It sort of is like there's kind of a pendulum swing that's happened. Like since we started finding really beautifully preserved like feathered specimens in China in the 1990s, everything suddenly was like, oh, we think there was feathers on everything. They're just not preserved well enough. And then the more time has gone on, the more specific like specimens we've found that are like, oh, wait, here's a skin impression. And we know it's from the upper thigh, or here's a skin impression from the lower tail. These weren't feathered here. And there's been a lot of conjecture and talk about like, well, maybe they were only feathered when they were young for like thermoregulation reasons. And they lost the feathers as they got bigger because they were better able to regulate their internal temperature. And now it's sort of a mix. Like there's dinosaurs we know had feathers for sure, totally head to toe covered in feathers.
Because of the fossil record, like we see imprints of feathers?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
It's specific species, you know? And then it's sort of, the conjecture is in different like ages, you know? Maybe a large T-Rex wasn't feathered, but maybe the younger ones were. Maybe they lost the feathers. Maybe they had feathers when they were hatchlings and they lost them immediately. That's where a lot of the like the conjecture and like the discussion is happening now. It's less about like all one thing or another. Now it's all shades of gray.
Yes, that happens in a lot of sciences as you advance.
Yes, the more we know, the less sure we are about it.
Exactly. Yes, the more you know, the more you know you don't know.
That's right. That's growing up.
For sure. What would you say are some of the misconceptions or surprising things about the ancient world that you like to dispel or communicate through your work?
For the general public, like the misconceptions usually involve dinosaurs as like mindless killing machines or monsters or like scaly tail draggers. There's a lot of that kind of leftover impression from depictions in like the 80s. Where we were still kind of showing them as like skinny, scaly, runny, bitey creatures.
Right. Yeah, that's what I grew up with.
That's right. But the more we learn and the more we find, like the more dinosaurs become real animals and not monsters. They're not monsters.
Yeah.
They're creatures like everything else that exists, you know, have similarities and similar lives to things that we still see today. Thinking of dinosaurs as like real versus thinking of them as like Hollywood movie monsters.
And how do you fight against that conception in your work?
I try to show them doing more like naturalistic behaviors or present them in ways that are like, this is a family unit, or there's some sort of like parenting interaction or familial interaction. They're just doing something plain and normal. Like show everything on a Tuesday afternoon doing whatever they would have been doing and not at like the height of the drama in their lives.
Right. I don't know. I imagine that that's in part imagining the parts of their lives that aren't so hellbent on survival, like their play, their family units. Like, have you had to imagine what it would look like for dinosaurs to play together?
Or just to like be traveling and like the interactions that they would have with each other, like, you know, something as simple as like a mother turning and calling to a straggling youngster, like things that are subtle and small, but like real.
That people definitely notice.
Yeah. And not to make them so overly dramatized. I like to show them like you would show, you know, wildlife art. Show them being beautiful, majestic creatures that just are.
You mentioned wildlife art before. Is the main difference between that and paleo art the scientific rigor involved in how you portray them?
I suppose. I think wildlife artists definitely try to depict things naturalistically. You know, like you can tell if somebody drew an elephant weird. They try to make things as realistic as possible. And paleo artists do the same thing. They just have to know a little more.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So it's a fuzzy boundary between the two of them.
I think of it that way.
Mm-hmm. Any other surprising things people don't know about the ancient world that you wish they did?
I think what's surprising maybe is how similar like ancient worlds could be to today. It's not so much that like everything was so very different and completely alien. It's that like there are repeating patterns in nature that happen today that would have happened back then. And it has they're more similar than they are different. And we can learn a lot about prehistoric worlds by understanding more about the modern one.
Yeah, that's a great point. Do you ever, when you're like walking in nature, get a flash to imagining what it was like in the Pleistocene, maybe?
Oh, totally. It's so easy to like walk through a landscape and see like a hawk chasing a rabbit and think back then that used to happen with like an Argentavis chasing an antelope, you know, like this could so easily be scaled up or scaled down. Any of these interactions or these like ecosystems, they all just repeated throughout time in different ways.
And from my astronomy background, I know that it also just repeats on larger scales, like out in the universe, which is fractal. Like you see these same patterns when you zoom out.
In art, we say form follows function. Mm. And I think that's true in the natural world. We can learn a lot about what a dinosaur's life was like based on their form. You know, what are their teeth like? What is their beak like? How are they built? Or do they look like they could run? Or were they built more like a tank because they had to defend against something in their environment that was going to eat them? Mm. The form tells you a lot about that story.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. Okay. So you didn't want to talk about Ice Age, but do you want to talk about Prehistoric Planet, the BBC show?
I'll talk about Prehistoric Planet. I'll talk about that all day.
Yeah. How did they do? My cat Cosmo really loved watching it.
You know, it was the dinosaur documentary I always wanted deep in
really?
My heart. It was so good. I really can't like nitpick about any of it. I thought it was exceptional. Just hands down the best depictions of
wow
art of like dinosaurs in modern art that I've seen. And it was so great that it came out sort of contemporaneously with the Jurassic Park movies, because mm-hmm. they are definitely two sides of a spectrum.
Okay, so it was just like really accurate in a way that other documentaries about dinosaurs have not been.
It was really a revival of like the Walking with Dinosaurs documentaries from like the late 90s with the same kind of purpose. And I think it's so valuable to have that out there in the world for the public to consume. And I think it was received really well.
Good. Do you think there will be more paleontologists inspired by this, like young future paleontologists?
Oh, totally. I think we're living in like a new revival of dinosaur content. I think we're going to see a lot more people interested in dinosaurs. There's a lot more information out there now. And oh man, there's such good work being done. There's so many people in the field doing amazing things.
What's some of the research that you are most excited about right now?
I've been following a lot of things that are coming out of the Arctic in different places in the world. Like there's a double-edged sword with the whole melting permafrost situation. But yeah. The upside is that we get things that melt out that are like mummified mammoth calves and things. And I am just like endlessly fascinated by those things. Like who knows what's going to fall out of some bank on the river up in the Arctic next week? Like anything.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
What do you feel like you still need to know? I mean, the textures of skin, you mentioned tusk cross sections earlier. Like how, if you had to guess, how much information are we missing? Do we know like 30% of what happened or like two?
Well, I mean, it depends on what period you're talking about. There's still
That's
areas
fair.
That are badly misunderstood.
Unfortunately. Yeah. Areas of time and space.
Yes. Yeah, there's a lot of places that have sort of been like almost over-collected, and there's spaces that haven't really been explored at all. And unfortunately today, like it's harder to do good paleontological research because of lack of funding. And then the fact that like fossil specimens that should be in museums are being sold at public auction for outrageous sums of money is a real unfortunate situation. I just wish there was maybe some way of regulating that process, because we're going to be losing really cool specimens that should be studied, and they're just going to disappear into like private collections.
Oh, that's so sad. Well, to lighten the mood, do you have any advice for all of those aspiring paleo artists who saw a prehistoric planet and were like, well, that looks awesome, I want to do that?
I would encourage people to like jump in and like just do your research. It's really important that like you don't feel like you don't belong in this field. People that come at it from an artistic background can make contributions just as much as people that come at it from an academic background. You know, in addition to studying art and like practicing your art, the only thing that's really important is that you kind of speak science as a language, you know, understand anatomical terms, be able to follow like scientific descriptions, understand classifications and time scales, geological terms and like geographic locations. And that is how you will get the most out of your interaction with the field and things that you can read. And there's a lot out there that's really easily available.
Do you have any favorite resources that you would recommend or people to follow? Do you have any paleo art idols?
Those are different questions.
Those are different questions. Yeah. You can answer whichever one you want.
I guess my paleo art idol is still James Gurney, author, illustrator of Dinotopia.
I love Dinotopia. Yeah.
He was such a huge influence on me and is still just fantastic. And just the nicest person.
Good. I'm always happy when I hear that people who did cool work were also cool people.
Highly recommend.
Nice. Can you think of any resources? Any programs or software that you use or places that people could submit early art?
I tend to try to do my own research. I don't follow the trends in the art so specifically, although that is a very wide and interesting sort of Twitterverse if you want to jump into dinosaur internet world. A lot of people working in it. What I'd want to say is that there's sort of this pervasive impression in the paleo art online community that art can be more or less correct. And usually what's meant by that is that it adheres to the most up-to-date science. But I want to say that there's many artists in various skill levels and lots of different styles that still contribute really beautiful and valuable work to the community. And I just want to say in the end, everyone is wrong. We're all wrong. We'll never know for certain what animals looked like or what their lives were like. You will never know. So every work of paleo art, regardless of quote accuracy, is by definition wrong. So, you know, be gracious and kind, and art should be appreciated on many levels, not just accuracy.
Yeah. Great words. Great advice. I hope that anyone listening takes that to heart, even if you're not interested in paleo art, because I think that's good advice for whatever field you're in. You are welcome in it, and you should not feel like you are out of place. Well, those are all of the questions I had. Do you have anything else that you want to say about paleo art before we start wrapping up?
You know, if you're interested in paleo art or in dinosaurs in general, just go out and find some. Find people that are making work that you like. Find places that you can go and see fossils and museums that display beautiful work, and just get into it. And don't feel like you need somebody's permission or a degree, for example. Just do it. We need people. We need people that are passionate and interested, and everyone should be welcome.
Yes, we need people. I'm so glad, Beth, that you are one of those people. So can you please take a moment to brag about yourself and tell us all of the very cool things that you're working on?
Oh, man. I've got my fingers in different projects at any given time. I'm not always allowed to post about the things that I'm doing until quite a bit of time afterward.
Okay.
So you can see a slightly outdated version of my work online.
What is something that you are very proud of having done?
You know, some of the big murals that I've done recently, I think just turned out really cool. There's a huge mural that was for the Royal Alberta Museum. That's this gigantic Ice Age landscape. I really had a great time working on that one. There's so much to it. I posted it on my website in just tons of detail photos too, because there's all these little moments in a mural. It's not just one image. It's so many different detailed moments throughout the whole thing. There's a lot to it. So I'll work on a piece for like 3 or 4 months and post it online and be like, here it is. It's it. It's done. It's the one thing. But I encourage people to take a closer look because there's so much that goes into a piece like that.
Yeah. And especially if you're experiencing it digitally, take advantage of that Zoom function. Get in close up and personal to those details. I know you've done other cool stuff. I know, for example, that you made money. Like you, you designed money.
Like, really? That's news to me. I don't make Yes, I'm part of the Artistic Infusion Program for the United States Mint. So I design coins and medals as a side project. And I get to work on all kinds of different really fascinating topics. They turn me on to all kinds of like historical people and events that I don't know anything about. So it's really a door that like allows me to have an excuse to really like learn more all the time. And I get to work on the smallest possible canvas because the other half of my work is working on the largest possible canvas. It's a very, you know, healthy exercise for my brain.
Yeah. I was impressed that you managed to fit all that detail on those tiny little coins.
It's a challenge.
Awesome. Well, Beth, how can people find you and your work on the internet when they hear this episode and are like, well, she's awesome. Let me look her up.
Well, I definitely encourage you to go check out our work at Blue Rhino Studio. You can find us at rhinocentral.com. We are working on big prehistoric projects right now. We've got dinosaurs in the shop all over the place. I'm wrapping up some big Cretaceous era murals for the new Edelman Fossil Park at Rowan University. And we also are just starting some gigantic prehistoric stuff that's going to go in museums in the Middle East and also just outside San Francisco in a couple of years. I don't know when we'll be able to post updates. We are just notorious for posting late updates, as am I. but definitely look out for Blue Rhino Studio online. It is super worth it when we do post updates because we are making just the coolest stuff in the world, honestly. Stuff people usually have to pay to go see. You know, check it out online. If you're looking for just me, I post also notoriously late and intermittent updates at fzakin.com or on Insta or Twitter at bzakin, B-Z-A-I-K-E-N.
The links to your pages and to Blue Rhino's pages will be in the show notes so they can find those easily. Listeners, just look at the blue links down below the title of this episode.
You will not regret it.
Mm-mm. All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your journey and your expertise with me. I am really excited about after this going and looking up pictures of dinosaurs and other ancient creatures. So thank you. And that's a wrap.
It's been a pleasure.
Exolore was created by me, Moya McTeer, your friendly neighborhood doctor of the universe. The show is edited by all-around audio genius Misha Stanton. The cover art is by Stephen J. Reisig, and the theme music is from purpleplanet.com. You can find episode transcripts at exolorepod.com. That's exolorepod.com. If you'd like to support Exolore, the best way to do that is to share it with your friends. Get the show in more ear holes, please. You can also support the show financially at patreon.com/exolorepod. Exolore is a member of Multitude, a collective of independent podcasts, all of which are fantastic. Check them out by typing Multitude, that's M-U-L-T-I-T-U-D-E, into the search bar of your favorite podcast app. Stay up to date with Exolore news by following me/us on Twitter or Instagram at ExolorePod, and you can follow me, Moya, at GoAstroMo. Please share this episode with someone you think will enjoy it, and be sure to subscribe to the show. That way, you can catch me next time on another world.